The Kashi Vishwanath Temple and Gyanvyapi Masjid controversy is not a new one. You can take it right back to 1669. That is 353 years back, when it is documented that Aurangzeb ordered the temple that stood there to be destroyed, to be demolished, and have a mosque built in its place. In fact, by also using some materials from the temple. That is a historic fact, and that's also been acknowledged as such. At this point, however, this very old issue has become top of the mind, because what's happening in a Varanasi court? A Varanasi court gave order allowing petitioners who've been wanting the area around the mosque surveyed on the plea that parts of the temple still exist there. And that's how this controversy over the structure in the wuzu pond or wuzu tank, whether it's an ancient Shivalingam or it is a fountain. That's how this controversy has arisen, because the court allowed a survey of the place. Now, this is a very polarizing issue. So if you want gyan on the issue, or if you just want to be excited, or if you just want to be on one side, then you can watch any of our television debates, because this is a classical TV debate subject. You put two on one side, two on the other, maybe a third guy, so A and B fighting each other, and maybe C virtue signaling. But it doesn't make us any wiser. So what are we doing? We are doing it in a totally old-fashioned cut the clutter manner, and giving you facts, one, from history, two, from law, three, from the constitution, and where do we stand, and then what view you want to take on it, we leave that to you, which is the spirit of cut the clutter. So first of all, let's understand the history of the place. Now, the history of what happened here in 1669 is very well documented, because some of it has also been written by Emperor Aurangzeb's own historians and his own chronicler. So there is a document from that time called Mathir-e-Alamgiri. Now, Mathir-e-Alamgiri, there's a passage from this which has been interpreted differently by historians, who you might say historians of the secular side and historians of the Hindu right. So historians of the Hindu right interpret this passage to mean that Aurangzeb was this terrible Wahhabi Islamist fellow who asked for all temples in India to be demolished, and that's how the great temples, very important for Hindus, most certainly the Kashi Vishwanath temple in Varanasi and Keshav Dev temple in Mathura, they were demolished. However, the other interpretation of this is, these are translations. So the first interpretation has sort of followed on from historian Sitaram Goyal, who the Hindu right quotes, trusts and quotes quite frequently. He was a serious historian. He wasn't just anybody or a Chandamama historian. He was a serious historian of a certain view. It so happens that over the past many decades, the view which has become more prevalent in Indian historical debate has been the view of the secular left. Now, Sitaram Goyal saw this as Aurangzeb basically giving an order to demolish all temples. The other side's view, I lean on Richard Eaton. Richard Eaton, now 82 years old, is a professor at University of Arizona, and he is among the most respected historians of medieval India. And his book, India in the Persianate Age, is a classic. So besides the book, he has also written a two-part long article in Frontline magazine more than 20 years ago. And I'm sharing links of both these parts with you in today's description, so you can read these articles. What is most interesting with his articles is that he's actually given a full inventory of all the temples desecrated under the Muslim rule, say right from the times when the first Muslim conqueror came into India. So he has listed them all. You can see this list on my screen. It's very comprehensive. And when you see this, a lot of temples have been destroyed and desecrated. What he does, however, is he puts this in a political perspective. So his view is that while Muslim rulers in India, they were building their Indo-Islamic state, as he calls it, they were not giving out blanket orders to destroy all Hindu temples, because in that case, nothing would have survived. So his view, which is the view of the view that today you might call the view of the secular left, is that destruction or desecration of holy places was used by rulers in medieval period as an instrument in their politics. So if they were happy with the Hindu ruler, maybe they gave money to a temple that the Hindu ruler was building. But if they got unhappy with the Hindu ruler, then they crushed the ruler, they massacred his population, and they also desecrated the temple. So he interprets the same passage from Mathurai Alamgiri, which is kind of a chronicle from Aurangzeb's times, differently. So I will just read the passage for you. This is a translation, and in his paper, Richard Eaton has also used Sitaram Goyal's book as his reference. In fact, the footnote mentioned there is Sitaram Goyal's book. Now, what is the exact translation? Translation is, orders respecting Islamic affairs were issued to the governors of all the provinces that the schools and places of worship of the irreligious, important, be subject to demolition, and that with the utmost urgency the manner of teaching and the public practices of the sects of these misbelievers be suppressed. Now, one interpretation of this would be that orders were given to destroy everything that did not belong to the Muslims and claim to be holy or claim to be a place of worship. In Richard Eaton's view, on the other hand, he puts great emphasis on the expression subject to. So he says that just before this, in fact, if you read the whole account and if you read the sentences that come in before this passage, it seems that Aurangzeb had received reports from his, whoever brought such reports those days to emperors, he had received reports that in parts of Punjab and Sindh, that is Multan and Thatta, both are in Pakistan now, and also in Varanasi and some other places, that Brahmins were teaching some kind of new books or some kind of new texts which were attracting Hindus as well as Muslims. And he had become insecure about that. And that's the reason he told his governors that you check out if anybody is doing this, then subject to your investigations, you can demolish a place. So again, it's a question of interpretation. You can see it this way, you can see it that way. Trust me, I'm not weighing in on any side on this. And if I have any views, I'm keeping them to myself. Then he mentions, and that's again an established fact, and that is accepted by historians on both sides. In 1669, there was a rebellion in and around Banaras by large landholders, zamindars, etc., many of whom were connected with the temple. Also, Aurangzeb suspected, or maybe somebody came to Aurangzeb and did some kanafusi, because Aurangzeb was also sort of smarting under the fact that Shivaji, his greatest enemy and his captive, has managed to escape from his captivity. So he was smarting under that, and it's very bad for a big powerful monarch's ego. So it's possible that people were going to him and maybe just making up stories and saying that Shivaji was helped along in doing this by some important people in Varanasi connected with the temple. Again, Richard Eaton says, the temple as it stood in 1669 had most certainly been built by Raja Man Singh, who had served Emperor Akbar, and now his great-grandson, Raja Jai Singh, was a big commander in Aurangzeb's army. And there was also suspicion, maybe it was just palace intrigue, but there was suspicion in Aurangzeb's mind that Jai Singh had also helped Shivaji escape, because Shivaji's escape was a humiliation for Aurangzeb. So because this temple was connected to the Jaipur royal family, and also he thought that people connected with the temple, these important big powerful landholders around Varanasi who were also now rebelling, they had helped Shivaji, he ordered the temple to be destroyed and a mosque be built. That's a historic fact. Neither the left nor the right can dispute it. The question is, now that you've inherited this situation, where do we go? Now, once you accept this fact, then all these arguments that go on these days on TV channels, including on social media, oh, look at that wall. That wall looks like it was a wall of a temple. This looks like this was a part of a temple. That should not be an argument, because it is established that a temple was destroyed and a mosque was built in its place. Now, it is around the same time, 1669, 1670, that it seems that Jats in the Mathura region has a very large Jat population, Even now, even in elections, Jat vote counts there. And so say the Jat party founded by Chaudhary Charan Singh used to win that constituency and was very strong in Mathura constituency. And that's the reason the BJP brought in Hema Malini and fielded her from Mathura, claiming or asserting that she is a Jat by virtue of being a Jat Bahu. Doesn't matter that she's a Tamil Brahmin, but she married Dharmendra, and doesn't matter that Dharmendra is a Jat, not from the Hindi heartland, but from Punjab. But she was projected there as a Jat Bahu. So Jats were always very popular in that region. 1670 or so, 69, 1670, there was also a Jat rebellion in this area. And then if you again read history from all sides, it does seem one fact you can establish is that these Jat rebellions became so successful that at one point they managed to kill the patron of the congregational mosque in Mathura. So both these things happened sort of around the same time, and Aurangzeb then ordered both temples to be destroyed. So the temple in Varanasi and the temple in Mathura were destroyed. In place of the temple in Varanasi, the mosque was built, which is now called Gyanvyapi Mosque. And in Mathura, in place of the temple, an Eidgah was built. Now, these are facts of history. Now, if you have these facts of history, so where do we go from here? Now, we come to the constitution, we come to the law, and we come to the judiciary, judicial pronouncements. So in 1991, as the Ayodhya movement was picking up, Mr. L.K. Advani was leading it with full energy and full force, and it looked like the situation was becoming quite heated. Parliament, this is when Narasimha Rao's government was in power, Parliament passed a law, Places of Worship Act. And you can see this law on my screen. It's a two-page law. It's a very short law. So the essence of the law is that nobody will force any change in the character of any place of worship that India inherited on 15th of August 1957. Because that was a watershed moment. And this law was to apply to every place of worship in India except one. And that one place was the Ram Janmabhoomi Babri Masjid issue. The reason that was kept out was simply because, not just because there was a movement going on at that point, but also because litigation in that case had started in the previous century. That was a litigation that had come in from the past. And this law also said that with passage of this law, if any other litigation is continuing about any other place of worship of any religion, that will now cease to exist. Which means, chodo kal ki baatein, kal ki baat purani, naye daur se likhenge, milkar nayi kahani. So that was the spirit of that law. So the BJP, as you would expect, did not support the law. The BJP opposed the law. Now, time moves, 1992, Babri Masjid is demolished and all this litigation goes on. And 2019, the Supreme Court gives its order. That order is very important. That's the reason we said this is rooted in history, law, and judicial pronouncements. So we told you about the history, we've told you about the law, and now the judicial pronouncements. So when the Supreme Court accepted the Hindu claim to the land where Babri Masjid and Ram Janmabhoomi Temple stood, they said a few things which are very important. So the 5-judge bench of the Supreme Court, which gave this unanimous verdict, they have been very, very astute in referring to the Places of Worship Act and actually positioning it in the basic structure of the Constitution. Because as you know, Constitution can be amended by Parliament, but only as long as it does not violate the basic structure of the Constitution. So bear with me, I'll just read for you a few lines from this judgment. So the judges have said, Supreme Court judges, and I quote, "The Places of Worship Act, which was enacted in 1991 by Parliament, protects and secures the fundamental values of the Constitution." So fundamental values, which is another name for basic character. "The preamble underlines the need to protect the liberty of thought, expression, belief, faith, and worship. It emphasizes human dignity and fraternity, tolerance, respect for and acceptance of the equality of all religious faiths is a fundamental precept of fraternity." Then the judges go on to invoke Article 51A of the Constitution, which talks about duties of the citizens. And they say that it isn't just the duty of the governments to protect these freedoms, it's also the duty of the citizens to make sure that they do nothing which violates these injunctions of the Constitution. Then they go on to say, and I am again quoting now, the Places of Worship Act imposes a non-derogable obligation towards enforcing our commitment to secularism under the Indian Constitution. The law is hence a legislative instrument designed to protect the secular features of Indian polity, which is one of the basic features of the Constitution. So they have positioned the Places of Worship Act in the basic features of the Constitution. Then they go on to say, and I am still quoting, non-retrogression, which means chodo kal ki baatein, gade murde nahi ukhado. Non-retrogression is a foundational feature of the fundamental constitutional principles of which secularism is a core component. The Places of Worship Act is thus a legislative intervention which preserves non-retrogression as an essential feature of our secular values. So you can see the judges are sounding repetitive, but they also want to take no chances. So they are saying again and again, they are giving protection of the basic structure or basic features of the Constitution to the Places of Worship Act. Now there is heavy rising demand that Parliament should amend the Places of Worship Act, and maybe by doing that Parliament will enable the Hindu side to reach the same sort of a denouement in Varanasi and Mathura or maybe elsewhere as they have in Ayodhya. But this Supreme Court judgment, if you go by the spirit of this judgment, it doesn't look like that even if Parliament passes a law, nobody can stop Parliament from passing a law, but that law will then have to stand the test of judicial scrutiny, particularly after the Supreme Court, a 5-judge bench has written this. Obviously, you can have a 7-judge bench, 13-judge bench, and you can change all of it, but it looks difficult unless there is a radical change to the Constitution, which is difficult to imagine right now. Now, in conclusion, I'll quote a few more lines from the judgment, because judges also say the Places of Worship Act is intrinsically related to the obligations of a secular state. It reflects the commitment of India to the equality of all religions. Above all, the Places of Worship Act is an affirmation of the solemn duty which was cast upon the state to preserve and protect the equality of all faiths as an essential constitutional value, a norm which has the status of being a basic feature of the Constitution. So once again, there is a purpose underlying the enactment of Places of Worship Act, the law, and then very, very prescient words, very good words. The law speaks, that is the Places of Worship Act. The Places of Worship Act speaks to our history and to the future of the nation. Cognizant as we are of our history and of the need of the nation to confront it, historical wrongs cannot be remedied by people taking the law into their own hands. In preserving the character of Places of Worship, Parliament has mandated in no uncertain terms that history and its wrongs shall not be used as instruments to oppress the present and the future. So, you know what was the essence of a law that Parliament passed with majority in 1991, with a large majority. You know the essence and the meaning of the Supreme Court judgment of 2019. What this means is that argument is not so much about history. All right, you can argue about history to say, did this happen or did this not happen? Was an injustice done or not done? That is an argument. And there is a valid argument, say on the Hindu side, saying that, look, you've been forcing us to stay in denial all this while. Let us confront our past. Let us know what happened in the past. The judges are also saying we should be cognizant of the past, but we should not let the past to hold our present and the future to ransom. And again, the essence of this law, 1991 law, and the Supreme Court judgment is that after Ayodhya, Babri Masjid, no other shrine can be reopened like this, whatever the history.